Hey, and welcome to the Android Central podcast for January 24th, 2019. My name is Daniel Bader, managing editor of Android Central. Joining me this week, Andrew Martinick. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. And you totally nailed that 2019 there.
I know. I've been practicing. It's been 2019 for 24 days. I should get it right by now. Jerry Hildenbrand, welcome back to the show.
Hey, hey, hey.
What's going on?
Everything's good. How about you?
Everything's good. Everything's good. We're gearing up for MWC. So this week, we're going to get into the weeds on the Galaxy S10. Lots of leaks this week going through almost everything we know about the S10 has sort of been fleshed out this week. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about rumors of the new Samsung Galaxy X or whatever the foldable phone will be called. And we're also going to talk about foldable phones in general. We have rumors about a foldable phone that's going to reignite the Motorola Razr brand. And we've seen a demo of Xiaomi's foldable phone, which looks surprisingly good, considering that this is really, really early new technology. And then, you know, we'll just talk about what everybody else is going to be launching in 2019, because holy cow, if you thought 2018 was boring for smartphone design, 2019 is going to be the complete opposite of that. It's gearing up to be a really, really important and interesting year. So Andrew, we'll start right there. We'll start with the Galaxy S10 today. As we were writing about, as we're recording this, there's I think the best leak we've seen for the, I think the major, like the bigger two devices, we have the Galaxy S10. We've heard it called the E, which is the light version. That is going to be probably marketed to different markets, you know, developing markets, depending on Samsung's goal there. But let's talk about the core Galaxy S10 and S10 Plus, because this is looking good.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of people have talked about this set of three as like the light, regular, and plus. But in reality, the light is not going to be like the main. That's not going to be the new starting point or anything like that. That's going to be something else, like you said, completely separately. You can think of the standard S10 as the baseline, just like all previous years. This side-by-side photo, they say that it's prototypes, but they look pretty darn finished to me. I mean, they even have like the little plastic film along the edges, like you get right out of the box. These photos from All About Samsung are about as close as we're probably going to get. And the thing that immediately stands out to me is that elongated, like, pill-shaped cutout on the S10 Plus is particularly in your face.
It is very, very apparent.
And it's in the top right corner, which I think is probably... Well, so there's two weird things about these screen cutouts. One is they're in the top right instead of the top left, which moves over kind of your standard status bar icons, your battery and cellular connectivity, etc. The difference in this one is that it's not a flat screen. It has your typical Samsung Infinity display, so it curves off of the edges. So the hole punch or the cutout is shifted inward from the edge a lot more than a lot of the other phones that we've seen. So there's like a lot of extra space on the outside of the cutout that kind of throws me off. What about you guys?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not going to be used for anything.
It's just dead space.
And it's way more pronounced on the S10 rather than the S10 Plus, because they've moved the single camera. And we're talking about the selfie cams here. If you're not looking at the same photos, head to androidcentral.com/galaxy-samsung-galaxy-S10 to see these leaks. Jerry, this is physics, right? They have a finite amount of space to put these cameras, but I mean, there is going to be compromise with any sort of design like there was with the notch. What do you think about this?
I look at them and I can't help but think, why the hell isn't that in the middle? I get why it's on the right. It's circuit board design, and you know, I'm sure there's a good reason that it's you know, well, to the right if you're looking at it. But it just looks, I can't wait for Renee to see this, because he's going to have a field day with how asymmetrical it is and how weird it looks.
Yeah, normally I don't have a problem with the off-center kind of punch or corner notches, but in this case, I'm really, really not happy with it, because it's off the cent, like off the side more than it's off
not,
the top.
It's not in the corner, because it can't be. I get why it can't be at the edge, but still, it's, what do they do in that football show? Come on, man.
Yeah, and it is interesting, though. So we're going to have double front-facing cameras on the S10 Plus. I guess there's a little more room, and, you know, well, and the S9, you know, they went from two rear cameras down to one rear camera on the small one. So, and on the S10 Plus, it looks like it's going to be triple rear cameras versus double rear cameras on the standard S10. But it just makes it look even weirder when you have this, when you have to do the... Well, I guess you don't have to do anything, but when you're going to decide to do the cutout and then you put double cameras in there, it just looks extra funky. I'm sure you won't notice it after you actually start to use the thing, just like I don't really think about the gigantic notch on the Pixel 3 XL. But I don't know. Looking at it with a completely blank static wallpaper and no icons on it, it really stands out.
What's interesting to me is, based on the leaks, they're moving the base S10 size, screen size, from 5.8 inches in the S9 to 6.1 inches in the S10. And they're moving the base S9 Plus size from, what is it now,
6.3
to 6.4.
Which is the Note 9 size.
Which is the Note 9 size. One presumes the Note 9 will also get a bigger screen this year. And then the Galaxy S, the Galaxy S10 Lite or E will get that more standard 5.8 inch screen size. So we're still shifting everything a little bit, but I don't think the actual phone size will be significantly larger, because they're going to say that they're fitting more into the same space, just as they did when they shifted from 16:9 screens to 18.5:9 with the S8.
And those top and bottom bezels, based on the look of it, are even smaller, especially the top bezel, because if you look at the top of a Galaxy S9, S9 Plus, Note 9 right now, the top bezel is decently large. I mean, for a variety of reasons, of course, but not the least of which being the front-facing camera. So as soon as you take that front-facing camera, it has a lot of Z depth to it, of course, but it's also relatively tall compared to just the only other thing that they have up there, which is the speaker grill. It's looking like, from these photos, it's just reduced down to basically the height of the speaker grill, and that's it.
Sorry, I want to make a correction. The Galaxy S9 Plus is 6.2 inches.
Oh, it's 6.2.
Yeah, the Galaxy S8, sorry, the Galaxy S9 is 5.8 inches. And then the Galaxy Note 9 is 6.4. So,
right.
And it's not easy to tell unless you have the two side by side, the Galaxy S9 Plus and the Note 9. It's clear the Note 9 is a bigger phone. It's more squared off.
It's also a lot heavier. You notice that when you pick it up.
Totally, yeah. And I wonder, you know, we're at this point now where we are almost at the infinity display, the goal that Samsung wanted from the earliest days, right, when it started increasing screen size. There's still a bit of a chin on the bottom. I don't think that's going anywhere. And, you know, unfortunately, they're still going to, which is ridiculous, they're still going to get criticized for that chin, because it's not the same size, or it's not the same reduction in size as, say, the iPhone 10 or 10s. But this is a real engineering achievement. I'm super impressed with how these look, despite the weird side notch, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's your one, that can be your one complaint there, is the the hole punch or whatever you want to call it. But this is just, they would have had to do something. And based on how people have reacted to just display notches in general, it sure doesn't seem like this is, I don't think they're going to pick up too many more critics with the hole punch. They were going to get destroyed by having a notch in the first place, because Samsung kind of stood for a really long time not doing notches. But I mean, they were going to have to do it at some point. I mean,
they're not going to call this a notch.
Of course not.
Like, they're not going to acknowledge that this is a notch.
I want to bet that they're not going to acknowledge it at all.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, what do they need to say? There's nothing that they can say, you know, when they go to announce this thing on February 20th that's going to convince anybody that it doesn't look kind of dopey. So they're just going to say, they're going to talk about the front-facing camera's capabilities, and they're going to talk about how amazing the display is and look at how small the bezels are. Why would, you know, just like Google didn't have to say a thing about the Pixel 3 XL's notch because, well, it was saying it itself. You just have to look at it, and that's what you're going to see. And you don't, like, they're not going to be able to explain it away and everybody all of a sudden be like, oh, yeah, I understand. No, you're never going to be able to rationalize it.
So what I find really interesting, aside from the main, you know, screen leak that shows the difference in size and the camera cutout, if you go down to the other two photos where you see the backs of the phones and the bottoms of the phones. Let's talk about the bottom for a second, because there's something here that is completely new. And I'm not talking about the headphone jack, which is new because it's old and very few other companies have it. I'm talking about the fact that the nano SIM slot, the micro SD and nano SIM slot is now integrated into the speaker.
Yeah,
Jerry.
I don't think that's what's going on here.
Is that not what's going on, or is that a microphone and I'm just getting weirded out by it?
I think that's a microphone. And
oh, it is. You're right. I'm sorry. And it's because of the way that the plastic is cut out.
Yeah, and if you follow what I did with my Essential phone, you will jam a SIM card ejector into that microphone and mess up the microphone.
Yeah, don't do that. Sorry. I'm looking at this going, there's a perfectly round cutout for the SIM slot, but I'm getting it's an optical illusion because there's plastic around it.
There's no reason they couldn't put the SIM card slot there. But it, you know, that opens up and it slides in behind the speaker or something. Oh, you're not the only one who thinks that, you know, who thought that that's possibly where the SIM card goes. I've had a couple conversations about that.
Huawei put the speaker inside the USB-C port with the Mate 20 Pro.
Smart.
Smart and dumb, depending on whether you have a pair of USB-C headphones plugged in. But
and do you remember the, which of the, was it the Droid Turbo that had the SIM card slot in the, was the rocker switch for the volume keys on the side?
I think so.
You know, like, you could put that SIM card in some really funky spots.
Or you could just make a removable battery and put it on, you know, underneath the battery, but whatever.
Oh,
like the good old
get
days.
Out of the comments of this article.
Yeah, it's funny. I was rummaging through my massive drawer of old phones, and I came across an old Samsung phone. It wasn't the S5, but it came out around the same year. It was like one of those rugged phones. I think it was like the X Pro 2 or something, and it had a removable battery and the whole. You know, you put the SIM card and micro SD underneath the battery. And I was like, was this better? Like, now that we're so far beyond that time period, and it's both nostalgic, but also like very clear that it's an improvement not to necessarily have to deal with removable batteries. Like, I don't know. Was it better? Was it worse? It just feels so anachronistic now. Definitely smaller.
The S5 had a 2800 milliamp hour battery. I don't think anybody would be happy with the Galaxy S. I mean, even the S10 Lite having only a 2800. I mean, it's rumored to have 3100, and that's on the small side.
Yeah, for a 3100, 3700 milliamp hour removable battery, your phone would be an inch and a half thick. They have to put
again,
a big
people would be fine with that.
Right. You have to put a big hard plastic case around the battery, and then, you know, a not removable battery isn't shaped like a little rectangle. It fits into every little nook and cranny.
I think that one thing, I do agree, Daniel, that I think the nostalgia has started to wear off a little bit and people have finally given up on it for the most part. I think that one thing people don't think about anymore is that these phones could not be as nice as they are if the batteries were removable still. That you can't do a nice, solid glass and metal body with a removable battery. It just doesn't work. We saw LG try to do something funky with the G5 with the removable battery and quote unquote metal, and that didn't work. It just, these on top of the size and weight concerns, just the build quality and the way that everything goes together and using glass on the back just can't happen.
Okay, so let's speak about the backs of these phones. We're going from one camera to three on the S10 and two cameras to three on the S10 Plus. Walk us through what we can expect from these cameras, Andrew, because not only are we going to get better lenses, better optics, but just more features.
I want to see them lean a little more into their processing. Samsung's always done a fantastic job and maybe hasn't gotten as much of the credit around the kind of AI photography buzzwords as Huawei and Google have. They're known for taking more of a traditional approach, but I don't think they actually do. All they really have to do is just keep on their same path. From my perspective, they may not get the plaudits of having the AI camera features and things like that, which those that they tried to roll out with the Note 9 were kind of a flop. They just need to, if they just take the exact same formulas that they're working on and put them together with better sensors and better lenses, I'm totally happy with it. They, you know, the Note 9 and S9 Plus are still amazing cameras.
I'd like to see one of those be an infrared camera just to grab focus and depth information, because then they could do some AI stuff that would be amazing.
So isn't that what that's what Huawei and Honor are doing of late, right?
Mostly, yeah. I just would like to see Samsung take the lead on that so it becomes more of a mainstream thing.
Yeah, the Honor View 20 has a secondary camera that's only used for depth. It has a 48 megapixel primary sensor, and then the second sensor is just a time of flight camera. It's just right to improve focus, improve the speed of the focus and the accuracy of the focus, as well as to give depth information. And it seems to work really well. I mean, if you there's always a compromise between size of sensor, number of megapixels when it comes to a phone. And I guess it makes sense that if you are leaning on a single sensor, you might as well make it as big as possible.
Yeah.
So, and then you use computation to hopefully improve the photo. You know, Huawei's done this really well with the Mate 20 Pro. They actually have three sensors in there to give you various types of shots, but ultimately the main sensor is the one that matters. And I think it works great. And, you know, Alex published a video this week on what he wants to see in the Pixel 4. And I think most people would agree that even though the Pixel 3 has the best photo camera on the market when it comes to phones, a second camera sensor of some sort, be it for telephoto or wide angle or just depth, would be better than not having a second one.
Yeah, more information, it always helps. And it would actually even help. I mean, nowadays, where all of these photos are, you know, they're not coming straight out of the camera, they're going through all this advanced processing, any additional data points has an outsized importance in giving you a higher quality photo. Where any time that the camera software has to interpret or just kind of come up with things or fill in the gray areas, it's not as good as if you just had an additional sensor telling you exactly what the colors were like or what the brightness was like or how far away that is, you know, etc.
Let's go back to these actual cameras, Andrew. What do you expect in terms of what each lens will offer?
I think it's standard. Well, there's two options. I think it's standard telephoto and some sort of a black and white or infrared, something like that. Or it's your LG standard long and then wide.
Yeah, I think that makes the most sense. Wide is becoming increasingly popular. Huawei's wide-angle sensor, a wide-angle lens in the Mate 20 Pro, pushed it into the mainstream in a way that LG phones just haven't been able to do. And it's a better sensor, it's a sharper lens, and it just works better. The transition between moving, the transition between the various lenses is smoother on the Mate 20 than it is on, say, the V40. I think Samsung will probably do it better than both of those companies because their camera app is amazing. And it's
their camera app is
reliable.
Really good. And they, I mean, we already see from being able to zoom between the standard and telephoto cameras on late model Samsung phones is already seamless. If they could do the same thing to go all the way to wide, that would be really good. It's really tough to tell. You look at the triple camera kind of setup and you can tell that one is dramatically different than the other two. It really does look like standard tele and wide because they still have their other sensor to the right, which is probably their infrared for autofocus and things like that. And man, Samsung phones in my experience, have been really good for autofocus already. So maybe they do go the LG way.
The cool thing is, since do believe it was Oreo, maybe it was Nougat, Android can grab the data from all these lenses concurrently. That's why you can switch between the telephoto and stuff so seamlessly, because it's getting a live view all the time. So
yeah.
There are some really cool camera tricks, I'll use that word, that could be done with, like you said, you know, maybe one's telephoto, one's wide angle, one's normal. You have all that data available to you at all times. The right person writing the software could have a field day with that.
Yeah, I do wonder the big hook will be. Samsung, every single phone release has one big camera thing that they try to trot out, you know, whether it's super slow-mo or, you know, their 4K recording or the Zoom or whatever. I hope they do something a little more interesting than LG's triple shot or whatever that is kind of lame.
I mean, there is a lot of value in getting three shots from different focal lengths. I just think LG does it so poorly. And assumes that people want this little video with music instead of just getting three photos from the same from various vantage points at the same time. That's brilliant. And if they just did that,
and one thing that Samsung could learn from LG in particular is having the cameras have the same or very similar sensors and optics qualities. To where when you take those three in a row, like on the LG V40, you don't get dramatically different looking quality photos. I think that's one thing that really throws you off on LG's cameras in particular.
Having the same focus spot with different lenses is an amazing trick. Let's start there and have crisp focus when you're gathering, you know, shots from different lenses at the same time. Is going to be hard to do.
And, you know, one thing that's really important here is that Samsung has the ability to source that quality and that consistency of sensors, right? Whereas LG may not.
And, well, if they can't source them, they can make them.
Yeah, Samsung's ISOCELL sensors are really good, and they use those in the international versions of the Galaxy S products, which leads us to kind of the next conversation, which is this will probably be the first series of phones running the Qualcomm Snapdragon 855. And Andrew, you and I got to benchmark this flagship SoC in Vegas, and it's an impressive looking upgrade from the 845. It's the biggest year-over-year graphics and computational jump since the Snapdragon 800, and that's been a long time.
And I just want to see, I want to see Samsung do something with it. I mean, the latest generation, I mean, really isn't stressed by what you're trying to do on the Note 9 and S9 and S9 Plus. You know, what are they going to do, especially when it's paired with 6 or 8 gigs of RAM? It's like, you know, are they going to continue to try to push the whole DeX thing and push the desktop capabilities of it? Because that, you know, that hasn't really been a huge draw, but these processors are so powerful that they can absolutely do it.
Because unless they do something different, that's a lot of wasted computational power. The S8 was overkill in the processor department. You didn't use, you know, as much as it was capable of. And that's going to get worse as the processors get better. Now, I don't mean it's worse for us. We won't see anything. It'll still look like it's instant. But Qualcomm's putting all that R&D money and making the processors so much better. Whoever steps up first and actually does something with them, you know, that's what I'm waiting for.
So we have a processor that's considered overkill, maybe. But, you know, Samsung is also taking advantage of all of the other improvements here.
Right.
It's not just, you know, faster benchmarks. It's not just a better GPU or, you know, higher clocked prime core. It's improvements to the image signal processor, to the way that it deals with AI, and in general, just how much more intelligent and dynamic this chip is compared to the 845.
Right. All the coprocessors have been vastly improved too, which is where we really want to see growth. So this is going to be cool.
Is it safe to say that battery improvements are going to be something that we can tout in 2019? Because the difference between the 835 and the 845 from a battery efficiency perspective was not drastic.
It's probably going to be the same. The battery efficiency is there, but when you bump up, like, you know, the AI coprocessor and the people making the phones and the software use all of that, well, that uses more battery power, so it kind of offsets your savings. So it's not going to be drastic, but it could be.
All right. So finally, let's talk about cost. This is not really something we can know. But rumors have it that this will be a much, much more expensive series of phones than even last year. The regular S10 is expected to be about 930 euro, which could translate to about $1,000 US. The S10 Plus will be sold for around 1,049 euro, which could be about $1,100 US. And then there's rumored to be an 6 and 8 gigabyte variant, which would give 128 gigs and 512 gigs of storage, respectively. Andrew, this would be a pretty big jump over the S9, which began at $729 for the standard S9, I believe.
Yeah.
Or $749.
I think it was $720, I thought. $720 and $820, whatever, roughly that. It's funny that we kind of forget that those phones were kind of cheap by like, you know, modern $1,000 phone standards. And that was just, you know, the beginning of 2018, that the S9 Plus even was, whatever, $825 or something like that is not that much compared to spending $1,000 on a Note 9 or a slightly specced up Pixel 3 XL. So these prices don't look that surprising to me at all, honestly, especially we've gotten to the point now where the standard S10 is not, it's not the small one anymore. I mean, it's just the big phone and then there's the bigger phone. Whereas the S9 still felt like it was the slightly smaller than average phone. And, you know, it only had the one camera on the back instead of the two and the slightly smaller battery. It still felt a little compromised and it was a little cheaper. Based on everything here, it looks like really it's just slightly smaller and missing one of the two front-facing cameras. Not surprising at all that they would try to charge, I would think, somewhere in the mid-900s for it.
Maybe that's why they're making the S10 Lite. They're going to do, you know, exactly what we saw Apple and Google do because they have to.
I guess so. I just think, okay, so, you know, this we talked about this with the Pixel 3, right? The standard Pixel 3 went from $649 to $799, which was a pretty big jump. $649 today for a flagship of the Galaxy, of the Pixel 3's caliber is really cheap. And right now, even, yeah, it's on sale for that price. You can get it for $650. I mean, we always go back to the fact that most people in North America don't buy their phones outright and that they finance them over 2 years or even 3 years. So it isn't that important what the total cost is. It's just about how much you can, how willing you are to break it up. If $20 is, if you could do $30, it's easier to stomach than, you know, spending $1,000 outright. But it's still an important metric.
Oh, it's still a lot, yeah.
And I mean, the whole, and we have to remember, there was all of this talk around the iPhone XR being only, quote, only $750 compared to the iPhone XS, which was $1,000, and how so many people in the Apple universe framed it as a budget phone, which, yeah, is absurd because it's $750. So I don't know, is the Galaxy S10 E or Lite going to be considered a budget version of the S10? Of course not. I mean, the budget version of the Samsung lineup or the S lineup or the Galaxy lineup in general is the J line, the A line, the M line that's being announced, you know, as we speak. Those are being rolled out in dozens of countries, and they may not be popular in North America, but yeah, Samsung's market share is not just comprised of North America.
But that's where I think the S10 Lite or whatever you want to call it is going to be. It's going to be in the same places where Samsung already sees traction for its upper mid-range phones, like the Galaxy A series.
No, I think this is a new category for Samsung. This is their flagship phone if you want something a little smaller or something that's flat, but you still want, you know, two cameras in the back. You still want the full screen experience. You still want the latest software, but you don't want a 6.5-inch phone or, you know, a curved phone. That's what Samsung's making.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're having a heated agreement here. I think it's just all about how it's positioned. It absolutely fills that space. If you're going to move up the standard S10 by $200 or so from where the standard S9 was, you have to have something that kind of gets into that middle ground, or you're just going to cede everything to the other Asian companies that are coming up with phones in that $500 to $600 range.
My gut tells me that the S10 Lite, and I'll bet they don't use that word Lite, is going to be their $700 phone. And knowing how well Samsung builds phones, it's probably going to be worth every penny of it.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting to put this in context because these are not the only three devices that Samsung is expected to announce
right
at MWC. Or near MWC. So let's shift the conversation a little bit to the company's foldable phone, the one that was proto-announced at the Samsung Developer Conference back in September. We've seen sort of a demo of this in the dark. We don't really know exactly what the phone's going to look like, but we do know that it will have a small screen on the outside and then open up the hinges right in the middle. And it'll open up to be a 7-ish inch tablet. This is going to be the form factor, the new form factor of 2019. So many companies are playing with this idea of the foldable
phone. Well, this idea anyway, but we're seeing lots of different versions of foldables, right? Yeah. Like, you know, what's on the inside versus the outside. And Samsung's doing two screens. Everybody else is doing one screen.
So let's talk about Samsung's version here, because we've heard so many rumors about its cost and its feature set and everything like that. But like any experimental form factor, we saw this with the Note Edge in 2014, and to some extent the Galaxy S6 Edge when it was introduced. It was introduced that same year, right? Or the year after? As the Note Edge.
The Note Edge was the end of the year before.
Yeah, and that's right. Okay.
Yeah. It was the Note Edge was the first one to do it with just the one side. And then, you know, 4 months later, they were like, oh, yeah, by the way, we could do this way better.
Yeah, exactly. And you've seen how that that chance worked out for Samsung so well. So here we are on the verge, on the precipice of another sea change in the smartphone industry with the introduction of foldable phones. And on the other side, we have 5G. And we'll talk about 5G devices probably in another podcast. But let's talk about the impact that this will have and whether it will be just some aspirational release or whether it's going to overshadow Samsung's own flagships this year.
I would just hope that they don't try to do the foldable phone at the same time as the S10, S10 Plus, and, you know, whatever potential S10 Lite or something like that. I think that that would overshadow the kind of mass market mainstream thing. And I think that if they continue, what I'm expecting is we're going to get something a lot more finished and kind of full product-y looking than what they showed off at SDC late last year. And if they do that, then it is worthy of its own anticipation and hype and then announcement separate from the S10.
I just hope they don't catch fire. Well, you've got that battery thing. I'm sure there's two batteries because you don't want to fold a battery in half. And then foldable phones just bring up a whole new set of problems.
Yeah, let's talk about those for a second. So we've seen Samsung's version. It's going to fold in the middle. We've seen Xiaomi's prototype, which will fold on the edges and sort of create these wings that fold underneath, which is really interesting. It's not clear whether those wings will actually have any function when they're folded. Like you probably won't be able to turn the phone around and use it, but check that out as well, because it's a really interesting demo. So let's talk about the limitations here. Obviously, batteries can't fold and glass can't fold. So how do you make a foldable phone work?
Well, the panel itself, I think it was 2012, LG invited Phil to Korea to look at a foldable AMOLED panel. And it was actually on a rolling thing, and it unrolled. So that tech, they've been working on it for a while, and I'm sure Samsung was working on it at the same time. But that's just a tiny bit. Glass, that's the big, that's what's really, I think, held us back as long as it did. Because it's got to be plastic. It has to be some sort of flexible plastic cover that you actually touch. And when is the last time you've touched a piece of flexible plastic that felt good to type on? So they had to work out something there. So there's some sort of polymer that, you know, maybe even almost feels like glass. But it has to give you a good tactile experience because you're touching it all day. Then you've got it's circuit boards don't bend, traditional circuit boards. They could possibly build flexible circuit boards, but I think it's probably two traditional circuit boards held together with ribbon cables like the batteries will be. You've got stress on that cable. There's a company that built a device a while back, and I can't say their name. I don't know if they want to talk about this, but it unfolded. The screen flipped out, and there was some problems with the ribbon cable because they didn't think that people would be unfolding that hundreds of thousands of times in a year. But you will be. You figure you probably unfold it 20, 30 times a day or more. And that's, you know, just an average user. So there's stress in all, everything inside is under a different type of stress that we've never seen before, that Samsung had to, you know, they had to look into a crystal ball and think of what people are going to do to their product and make the product safe, number one, and number two, something that you'll like. I would not buy this year.
Yeah.
Let the tech nerd friend of yours buy it that, you know, that is used to having things that maybe don't quite work as advertised, because there's going to be things that come up about a foldable phone that nobody could have thought of until it's in the hands of, you know, a couple hundred thousand people. But then 2 years from now, this is going to be what your basic flagship phone looks like, is my prediction.
I think that the plastic foldable screen covering alone is enough to get people to really question whether this is a good idea for them to buy. Samsung probably has, considering the technology right now, Samsung probably has the best idea of the group, because the plastic is protected when it's not unfolded. So Samsung's folds inside, where, you know, in like a book with the pages on the inside being the screen, and then has another glass covered additional display on the outside of the front cover of the book, which, you know, can be Gorilla Glass 5 or Gorilla Glass 15 or whatever they want to make
it. That does too. That gives you that glass experience at least half the time. And by folding in on itself, the panel, the OLED panel, is actually folding more than whatever polymer they're using is the final cover for the display. And Samsung can work on making that as flexible as they need to. That was smart.
Now, that of course makes the entire device more expensive and thicker and all that kind of stuff, because now you have an additional display and all that. But one thing that I have noticed, which I really was kind of blown away by, that little video of the Xiaomi double folding phone, but the one thing that is you take away when you look at that, or my time looking at that foldable phone from Royole at CES, was they don't come back flat very well.
Right.
Because the plastic has to be bendable, and there's one point that's bent all the time and the other points are not, it doesn't snap back to perfectly flat. And when you look at that video of the Xiaomi folding phone, he's holding it vertically where the folds are on the horizontal plane, and the thing is like crumpled over like a newspaper you're reading sitting on the train. And that, you know, all of these little things are like the kind of daily conveniences of, like, you expect your phone to be flat, and when you touch it, you expect it to, you know, be hard glass and not, you know, scratch with everything. Those will be reasons enough for people to kind of look elsewhere at the start.
Well, Samsung folding the display in on itself is going to have a big impact on not getting flat again, because the polymer doesn't have to stretch. The OLED panel
can
be the piece that stretches.
So I just wonder, when you look at Samsung's take on it, you know, from the demo we've seen, which was admittedly far away, you can't, when it's folded out, you can't see the bend line in the middle at all. But I wonder if we've done this 10,000 times,
yeah,
will there come a point where it'll develop some sort of what looks like a hinge just from, you know, repetition?
Because you're more likely to see that in the plastic than in the display.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the display we know can bend thousands of times. They've shown this. But I'm wondering, especially over time,
you know, given the fact that this has to be tactile when you press it, there can't be any flex. I mean, if you're the irony is that it's called, you know, Infinity Flex, but when it's open, it has to stay open. It can't be any flex at all in the middle. Otherwise,
and demos we've seen do have flex.
When you're touching something, if you're playing a game or typing or something, you don't want your phone dipping when you're typing in the middle of the keyboard at all. I mean, it has to be perfect.
Right. It has to stay hard. The entire screen from one corner to the next has to be hard. That's why they finally went with glass as a, you know, the cover on a bigger smartphone. This is, you know, well, I've been waiting for a company like Samsung to come up and show us this because
show us how it's done for real.
Yeah, it takes a company like Samsung or Xiaomi. I mean, Xiaomi is nobody to laugh at. They're a huge company as well. But it takes a company with money to spend on the R&D to do it almost right the first time. So I've been waiting for Samsung to show it off.
We have rumors of Huawei, rumors of LG. We know Xiaomi. We know Samsung. We've also seen a leak of a Motorola Razr redo that is purportedly going to launch around MWC. This was leaked in a Wall Street Journal article that says Lenovo, which now owns the Motorola brand, is looking to, I guess, you know, hit the nostalgia of people who love the Motorola Razr from their mid-2000s and bring it back in a a very expensive and relatively low output. We're talking about 200,000 units, which is very low for a flagship phone, and that it would be exclusive to Verizon. Now, we've seen a patent of what this could look like, where it literally does appear to be...
It's like a flip phone.
A flip phone. I mean, it flips up and it folds in and of itself. And then there's a little chin where I assume the battery and other tech will live. Jerry, what's your take on this?
I would love this. Granted, it has to be a smartphone. In this day and age, we say flip phone and laugh, but it's going to be an Android smartphone with a smaller screen that flips out over. And we've seen Samsung make these for the Asian market, and they're also outrageously priced. So maybe the tech to build it is expensive. But I would love it. I like a smaller phone, one I can carry around in my shirt pocket. This was made for me. The price and the Verizon exclusivity, you know, it's not made for me.
The interesting thing is that what we've seen with these whatever patent filings or whatever all these concepts are is really what the early patent filings of the Galaxy X showed, which was like a tall, skinny flip phone, for lack of a better term, that you hold vertically and it folds down, you know, on the horizontal axis, rather than all of these other devices that we're looking at as more like widescreen tablets that fold, you know, on the vertical to become a phone. So I actually do like this form factor, especially when you look at the way that all these phones are getting really narrow and really tall. It really kind of does make sense to just split those horizontally and have them fold down. And it solves a lot of the kind of ergonomic questions about how you use these phones when they're folded over and how do you hold on to the display part that's curved and all that kind of stuff. This really simplifies it.
I also think that it gets around this notion that a foldable phone becomes a tablet. This is a really, really small phone that becomes a regular sized smartphone that has a regular 18:9-ish aspect ratio that we're used to. If they can get it thin enough, the way that the first Razr was praised for its thinness, then I think this could be a really interesting product. My concern with what we've seen on, say, the Samsung or Xiaomi demos is that you're using this massive 7.5, 8-inch tablet in an aspect ratio that does not make sense to hold in one hand. And that is the primary use case for the phone. So are people actually going to want to use that? Is the software, Android software has famously not been optimized for those form factors. Is the software going to be updated to take advantage of it? I don't know. Motorola's makes the most amount of sense for me, but then it's kind of moving in the other direction. Do people want a small phone that becomes a regular sized phone?
Yeah, this technology has to be shrunk down considerably, I think, to make sense in that kind of tablet-y thing folds in half into a phone. Like, the aspect ratios just don't really work out right now. You look at what the Galaxy X, whatever it's going to be called, looks like when it's unfolded. It reminds me of a BlackBerry Passport or a LG View or something like that. It's just kind of this awkward middle ground where it's not big enough to be a tablet. It's too big to be a phone. The apps and software are going to look like trash on it. You know, there are lots of those little issues to deal with.
Yeah, that's the apps. That's your problem. Samsung, the UI will be beautiful. If you like the way the UI is on your Galaxy, you know, S9 or 9 Plus with the latest Android update on it, you'll like the UI on this foldable phone. But then when you go to the Google Play Store and install all your favorite apps, they're going to look like trash. And that's been Android's downfall since the beginning.
All right, so we're going to take our first break and thank a new sponsor to the Android Central podcast. I'm actually, you know, I've said this in the past. When we get sponsors that are promoting products that I actually like and use, I get excited because it's way easier to talk about it. And Eero is that product for me. If you don't know, Eero makes an amazing mesh Wi-Fi solution. They have a main Eero router that plugs into your cable modem, and then they have these beacons that you plug into various outlets around your house to give you really strong, dead spot free, no dead spots at all Wi-Fi. And they've released a second generation version that's now tri-band, so it has 2.4 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz, and 5.8 gigahertz, which is twice as fast as the predecessor. And they're so low profile. I mean, I have four of these in my house. I have the main Eero, and then I have three beacons, and they just sit in a power outlet and they just do their thing. But that is not even close to all you get with Eero. I mean, there are other mesh Wi-Fi solutions. Eero takes it to the next step with something called Eero Plus. Now, Eero Plus is designed to provide simple, reliable security that defends all of your home's devices against a growing number of threats, like malware, spyware, phishing attacks, as well as content that you may not want your kids to see. This combination of Eero and Eero Plus, it's a complete network solution, and all of the devices stay up to date all the time. So with Eero Plus, you can block malicious and unwanted content if you don't want it. You have advanced security with a database of millions of known threats. Eero Plus will basically prevent you from visiting the sites that they know will be trying to inject malware into your computers and devices. You could do content blocking. So if you don't want your kids visiting particular websites, you just plug that in. It's super easy in the Android app, and you're ready to go. But it automatically tags various sites. Like, it has this database of sites it knows you may not want your kids to visit, and you just press a button and it does all the work for you. And then it does ad blocking. So if you want to block ads from its growing database of sites that deliver bad ads, or, you know, all ads in general, which can improve load times, it does that as well. It comes with free VPN protection through encrypt.me. It also comes with a free subscription to 1Password, which
all of us use here. 1Password is an amazing password manager, and it comes with a free subscription to antivirus software from Malwarebytes. This is all included in your Eero Plus subscription. So, you know, to summarize it, you get a single router model with as many beacons as you want. It's distributed. It gets automatic updates. There's an amazing app, and Eero has really, really good customer support. So if you ever have any problems, you basically just open the app and you get it solved immediately. So, you know, Andrew, you and I have these in our homes right now. Mm-hmm. I live in a very tall house, and I needed a mesh Wi-Fi solution, and it has completely saved me. You recently installed Eero, replacing another mesh Wi-Fi solution. Tell me about your experience.
Well, I don't have a very tall home because I'm in a single level apartment. But even with that, I had an issue. I still had issues with coverage, which is really weird because these mesh systems, they're designed to be mesh systems with multiple. So if you only use one, or you don't have something as simple as a beacon like Eero has, it makes it really difficult to get to expand to just that little corner that you needed. That's the nice thing about this beacon. I just have one plugged in under my desk here, and it just occupies that one spot. You don't have like this separate thing where you have to find a place for another router to go with a power cable and all that kind of stuff. So I can just keep the regular Eero where I have my other router, and then I can just put the beacon on the other side of the, you know, about 2/3 the way across the apartment, and I have no problem. And all the devices just hop between them, and it's just completely seamless. And now I don't have an issue with phones and the Google Home in my bathroom, which is on the other side of the apartment, two more rooms away, connecting. And all it does, you just plug it in and it just works. You don't have to configure anything. Or the big thing for me was just finding a space to put it. So you think about these mesh systems as being good for houses, but it's been a big revelation for an apartment for me.
So Eero is great for big houses, small apartments, everywhere in between. The one thing that I love about it, you know, I pay a lot of money every month for a gigabit cable connection. And the second I open the app, it tells me exactly how fast my network is right now. It does a speed test every morning, so you know if you're having problems with your network. If you are, you can just call your provider and they can get right on that. You can control access for every single device on your network. I have 34 devices connected on a regular basis right now. You can go in and configure each one. You can block ones that you don't want on your network. You can you can do so much with it. You can remotely reset your router. If I'm away on a vacation, or if I'm away at a conference, I can open the app and reset the router, no problem. You can set custom DNS. You can do so much. And with Eero Plus, you can make sure that everything on your network is protected from anything malicious on the internet. So I highly recommend getting Eero if you have any issues with traditional Wi-Fi. And right now, if you are interested in picking up an Eero solution, you just go to Eero.com/ACP and you get $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons and a year of Eero Plus. That's Eero.com/ACP for $100 off. And when you go to checkout, enter ACP and you're good to go. And we thank you so much for sponsoring the Android Central podcast.
Thanks, Eero.
All right. So let's talk about a couple of other devices that either we know about or devices that have already been launched. One such device is the Honor View 20. And we talked a little bit about this phone on a previous podcast, but basically, this is the only major phone release from CES. Alex just put out his review. It's got a left side hole punch, and we've been having this internal debate about whether hole punch displays are good or bad. Russell said they're terrible. They're worse than notches. Joe said they're better than notches. I don't really care either way. But this hole punch trend is going to be one of many throughout 2019. So we have rumors of a OnePlus 7 that's actually going to be a slider, which would be the first slider release in North America, like a major slider release. We've had the Oppo Find X and the Xiaomi Mi Mix 3, but neither of those were widely available outside of China. So, guys, what is going to be what's going to be the major trend for you in smartphone design in 2019?
I don't think that the sliders are going to be necessarily the big trend, but I'm actually starting to come around on them a little bit if it enables or as a proper stopgap between being able to figure out where we are now and being able to figure out how to get all these sensors and cameras and things integrated into or underneath the display. I'm kind of thinking that sliders might actually be all right after seeing these very odd hole punches and cutouts.
So, I mean, it's safe to say, Jerry, that the traditional notch, the one that kind of came with the iPhone X and has as quickly subsided in 2019, is pretty much dead, right?
I hate to say never, but I hope so.
And yet you said that the side notch is worse than a centered notch, or at least a side hole punch is worse than a centered hole punch. So is that what you would want to see? Like just punch right in the middle?
No, I'd like to see it where Samsung's putting it, just not on a curved display that has 3/8 of an inch of wasted space to the right. That's my issue with Samsung doing it, is all that wasted space because of the curve. And I think it would have been better just to stick it in the middle. But
yeah, it actually looks better on the View 20.
I mean, maybe BlackBerry can do something more cool with the symbol key. My phone has a headphone jack and no notches, no holes. Keep doing it, BlackBerry, TCL. Just keep making them. Please keep making them.
So we've also seen a teaser for what we believe is going to be the LG G8. And LG is teasing something called Goodbye Touch, which worries me.
Yeah.
Because every time LG experiments with something, it doesn't always work out.
Every time LG tries to reinvent the mobile industry, we forget about them for a generation.
But that's
not
fair.
What is this, though?
Because somebody comes and does it better, but we can't discount LG trying it. I like LG as a company. I'm sorry.
Oh, so do I. I think that they do interesting stuff, but we've kind of seen this no touch, waving gestures slash
just no.
Using the cameras to recognize where your hand is, you know, all that kind of stuff.
No,
it's really tough to do right. It's really, really hard.
It's tough to make anybody really want to do it. I'm sure something new will come in the future, but companies like Samsung and Google and Apple, they've spent billions and billions of dollars trying to figure out, you know, how people actually use the devices that they buy. And nobody's waving their hand over things. Nobody.
The only thing that I can think of that's actually worked in this space is the Note 8 and Note 9 with the S Pen. Because it's a fine pointed implement that knows when it's close to the screen, and the screen can react to things when you hover over it precisely with a pen. You can, you know, scroll by, you know, moving the pen close to the bottom of the screen but not touching it. You can highlight things, use a magnifying glass, all that kind of stuff. That's very neat. It's a lot harder to do, infinitely harder to do with just your hands rather than a fine pointing device.
Yeah. I'm not real happy with, you know, having to, I hate to use the word justify, because we always have to try to find, well, there's got to be something good, and I just don't think I'll be able to find anything good here.
What I'm curious about is, what is different now in terms of available technology that will make this experience significantly better than when other companies tried it with, you know, gestures or eye tracking
Probably nothing.
Yeah,
well, I think what LG could do is some sort of electrostatic sensing technology for the display itself that they can try to track where your hand is through the display, you know, through hardware rather than through optics. Maybe that's a reach, but I couldn't think of anything else that LG could do.
Yeah, it's a reach of that's you got that right. All right, so LG is also, you know, one of many companies rumored to announce a foldable phone, but there is another trend that I want to talk about that has popped up over the last couple of days. And these are devices from companies that they're not pretending that they're anything but concepts, but they're interesting nonetheless. And we have one more sponsor break to get through, and then we're going to finish out the show talking about these really, really interesting devices. So stay with us. Have you heard about this revolution in online furniture shopping and the company behind it? It's called Joybird. Joybird believes that you should never settle when it comes to your home furnishings, and that you should always have the freedom to be boldly original. From idea to reality, they empower you to create the space and furniture that brings you joy. With Joybird, you get one-of-a-kind furniture made to your unique taste. So if you have ideas on how to furnish your home, Joybird can make it happen. From mid-century modern to contemporary classics, customize your home in an amazing array of fabric choices, from rich, buttery leather and plush velvets to every color imaginable. Joybird sells a wide range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery as well, and there's a free personal design consultant to help you nail down your perfect design. So why choose Joybird? Well, they have quality, handcrafted furniture. Each piece is made by hand with care and precision, using high-quality hardwood and responsibly sourced materials to fit your exact specifications. And each piece you buy comes with a lifetime warranty. Not only that, you get a 365-day home trial, so you can sit on it, sleep on it, and break it in. If you don't love your Joybird furniture, return it for a full refund. And when you order, you get hassle-free in-home delivery and free returns within 2 weeks of your first delivery. So if you're interested in trying Joybird for a full year, go to joybird.com/ACP. That's Joybird, joybird.com/ACP, and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code ACP at checkout. Thanks, Joybird. And now back to the show. Okay, so let's finish out the show talking about something that I find really interesting. Last year, around this time, Andrew, Vivo announced the NEX. This is a phone that had a full screen display with a camera that popped up out of with a motor, so that
periscope
periscope phone, so that it didn't need to have a notch. This year, Vivo is showing off another concept called the Apex 2019 that has no buttons, no ports, no nothing. This is a 98% screen-to-body ratio, which is unprecedented. There's no USB-C port. There's no headphone jack. There's no...
That's me. That's the sound of me hyperventilating.
There's no buttons at all. No power button, no volume buttons, nothing. Then we have Meizu, that's showing off something very similar called the Meizu Zero. This one actually came first, but it's basically the same idea. No ports, nothing, has an in-display fingerprint sensor. Charges only with wireless charging. This is a trend that I did not expect to see in 2019. What's your take on it?
I didn't expect it to happen either, mostly because it's just, you can tell, I don't know. It's one of these things that looks really good, but functionally we know that it just doesn't work very well. You can remove a lot of things from a phone, but once you start to get to the functional issues and hurdles you have to go over to not have a charging port on it and not have buttons on it, you're really getting to the point where you're doing something and there's not a big benefit involved outside of just saying that you can do it. And that was kind of the reason why Vivo did the first Apex, where they've started to use this Apex name for these concept phones where they roll out all this kind of stuff. And then they make a commercially available one that's kind of just the same thing. It's neat, but it seems like a good idea. But in practice, you realize, well, it would be nice to be able to just plug this thing in, you know, and like, what did you accomplish by not having the USB port there? Not very much. I mean, it's just, what was your benefit as a consumer of not having the USB port there? I think that's the biggest question that can never be answered.
I'll agree with you on the USB port. This is just a way to force me to buy adapters from Vivo. But no buttons. We used to have buttons for the front of a phone, for back and home and answer calls. Now we use the touch screen. There's no reason you can't do that on the side for volume and power. Exactly the same thing. It doesn't have to be a glass display that shows part of your app. It's just a spot where you touch. That, I think, is really cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. But mostly the audio, and Daniel knew that was going to come up. So, Daniel, how does the audio work? Phone call audio.
I think it's, well, they're calling it...
Is it bone conduction?
Bone conduction, like, they're That's calling what it they body, did with the body sound casting, which, you know, sends the sound waves through the glass and essentially vibrates the sound, you know, inside, and then I guess projects it to your
ear. It's transducing the sound for your voice back to the caller. That's I really want to look at one of these. I'll be honest with you, because that's something that I don't think anybody even thought about. What can we do here? Get rid of the microphones? That's really cool.
I mean, what's interesting is that it's using the same idea as LG's boombox, where it uses the inside of the phone as a resonance chamber.
Yeah.
The only difference is that there's no port. It's throwing the sound through the screen. The glass and the touch layer is orally transparent, which is interesting. Fancy.
I'm really looking forward to finding out a little bit more about how it all works.
And Vivo actually says that there's no one place for its fingerprint sensor on the screen either. It's using something called a fingerprint light to light up the area around your finger, and then can detect your fingerprint anywhere on the screen, not just in a single place.
I saw demonstrations as far as a year ago that showed a full 1/3 of the display being able to work as the fingerprint sensor. So it seems possible.
I mean, it sounds less precise than what you would have right now, which is basically a camera projecting, you know, the screen projects light around your finger. A camera verifies that your fingerprint is a match to what's stored in the secure element in the SoC. This is probably not as secure. I can't imagine it could be, since the resolution is probably far lower. But
or is it using the Qualcomm ultrasonic fingerprint sensor?
It's not saying it's using ultrasonic. It's still saying it's using light to project, you know, to sort of make the camera more accurate. But who knows? I mean, it's possible. I mean, they're living in 3019 here, so
yeah. The fact that I can't just plug this thing in is immediately destroys it.
But yeah,
and it's a neat proof of concept.
Here's another thing that I find really, really interesting, especially on the Meizu. So I don't know about the Vivo one, but the Meizu one is interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, it's using 18-watt Super M Charge wireless charging, which is the fastest wireless charging that I've ever heard of. 18 watts is
that's extremely high
to what you'd get with USB PD plugged into a USB-C port on the Pixel 3. They're also using wireless USB-C, which is a standard, or USB, which is a standard that is not used that much. They're also using eSIM. So there's no SIM slot here. It's completely eSIM enabled, which is remarkable because at least over here, there aren't any carriers only selling eSIM. And then finally, they're using haptic feedback to imitate the feeling of physical buttons for the volume and power. I mean, there's a lot of innovation here.
Now, where have we seen this before, Daniel?
Well, we've seen it in a little device called the HTC U12 Plus. And
what?
How did that work out, Andrew?
I did not work out well, Daniel. So the interesting thing there was it even gave you the guidance of having like a physical bump there where you knew that the buttons were supposed to be. They just didn't actually move. The problem is just like the hovering display kind of touchless gesture controls, it's so tough to get the calibration right. And it's really easy to screw up the entire experience if they're too sensitive or too numb. And it's just, in theory, it looks really cool. And you're like, you can have these kind of tap and slide gestures anywhere along the side of the phone. We even saw this on the latest Sony phone, the XZ3 had the touch area on the side where you can press it to lower the notification shade or perform actions. The problem is that the fine tuning has to be so precise, and I just don't think that the capacitive pickup for it is you know, it's on the level where it needs to be to make that experience work.
Now, to be fair, HTC was trying pressure sensitive capacitive touch, not just I've got a Bluetooth speaker here that's capacitive for volume and power, and it works just
right.
Fine. So I'm going to bet that Meizu and Vivo are more along the lines of it's just a capacitive place to touch. The trick will be getting you to touch the right spot.
Also,
and
false positives.
Rejecting accidental touches, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the issue with things like the Google Pixel Buds was exactly that. It has a capacitive touch area that you're supposed to use to skip songs and increase the volume. But the issue with false touches made it so unusable that I never wanted to put them on. This would
every
be even
time you
more
touch
frustrating.
Them, they start or stop your music, even when you're trying to reposition them in your ears. I mean, this is a problem that all of these things have when you have the problem is it gets in the way of your regular use of the phone. And at that point, then you wonder why.
Yeah, I love this idea in theory. I think that this kind of innovation is so cool. I love that Vivo even had the audacity to remove the selfie camera. It's just like, screw it. We don't need it. Like, you don't have
good
to
riddance.
Use a selfie camera. Let's, heck, you know, there's two cameras on the back. I would very much like to see more companies do this because as good as the selfie cam is on, say, the Pixel 3, I really don't think that it's as necessary for most people as companies pretend it is. And if you are that interested in having a selfie camera on the front of a phone, well, there are a million options for you.
Was it Vivo that made the phone several years back where the camera swiveled and you could swivel the 18?
That was Oppo.
Oppo. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have one of those. It's awful. It's awful. But it made a lot of sense for the time, right? Like, having a single camera that would just swivel depending on where you needed it, it makes sense. And if the camera quality is good enough, you don't need a second camera. You just, you know, it could just work. But I mean, it must have been so expensive to produce those. And
yeah, not fond memories, just remember it.
There's a Vivo Nex
what's it called? The Vivo Next something edition, special edition that has two screens so that you can use the rear screen as a selfie camera.
Yeah. That
was just announced recently.
I remember that too. I thought that was pretty cool. And that's something that as technology gets further, that can be done without adding any cost to the phone. That'd be kind of cool. That's a way to get rid of your notches and everything.
And that's kind of the idea of all of this stuff. I think that the best way that we're going to experience any of this technology you see in the Meizu Zero or the Vivo Apex 2019 version is bits and pieces of what these companies are doing, propagating elsewhere around the industry. There may be a point where people are willing to give up that front-facing camera or they want to use the little periscope camera or something, but it's not going to be in a phone that also doesn't have a USB-C port and doesn't have buttons. You know, I think any one little piece of these phones is like, wow, that's really neat. And like you were saying, Daniel, really interesting from a technology standpoint. But when you put all of these ideas together in one phone, you're like, well, that's not viable.
Yeah, but do they really expect to sell very many of these?
I don't think they do.
Yeah, they're relying on the mid-range phones that they sell by the millions and millions to bankroll this kind of stuff.
Yeah, what struck me really was that I think it was the Oppo R16 Pro or the R17 Pro.
R17?
Yeah, it's Oppo's kind of like mainstream device for 2018. It ended up being
the R17.
Yeah, it ended up being the best-selling phone in the world in terms of numbers, like it because it sold so many in China. It ended up being the single most successful phone of 2018. And I just this is so humbling to look at because there's nothing original necessarily about this, but it takes...
Oh, it's the least original phone.
Right, but it takes all of these good ideas from all of these other phones, be it an Oppo phone or a Vivo phone or a Samsung phone, and it puts them in a device that is very affordable, aspirational from an aesthetic perspective, and it's just good. It just does a good job at being a phone. So, you know, that's what I find so interesting about this.
It's the Toyota Camry.
It's the Honda Civic, which sells more. I think the Civic sells more than the Camry.
Ooh, I don't know.
I don't know. At least here in Canada, I know the Civic sells more than any other single model of car in Canada. It has been for like 20 years.
But that is one thing to keep in mind there. The reason why something like the R17 can just be just total gangbusters for 2018 is it doesn't have to do all of this crazy stuff. And these companies, you know, Oppo can just put this out, which is like the most like just generic, like meld every other phone together and don't do anything super risky and sell a ton of them. And then at the same time, that can help fund other crazy stuff like, you know, what Vivo is doing. And, you know, like Jerry said, Vivo and Meizu are doing the exact same thing. They have their Toyota Camry version too, but, you know, these are their concepts.
All right. Well, you know, I think 2019 from a phone design perspective is going to be pretty damn interesting. I'm looking forward to it. We didn't even touch on all of the 5G phones that are supposed to be announced at MWC and beyond. If you think about MWC being a convention for network, you know, announcements, this is an appropriate place to announce the Samsung 5G phone, LG, Huawei, you know, all of these devices that Qualcomm has been working on, getting its X50 modem into all of these flagships for the last couple of years. This is the place we're going to see final versions of that. So if you're into 5G, you've got something to look forward to. Foldable phones, got a lot to look forward to. Or if you just want the mainstream goodness of something like the Galaxy S10, we're getting that on February 20th, which is annoyingly right before MWC, but whatever.
Yep. Less than a month away.
So yeah, it's going to be good.
Do you know what else is cool? You can like, what is it? The Wish? You can go on the Wish app and get, my neighbor just got one. I think it's the P20 Lite from Huawei for $199.
Yeah.
And it's a hell of a phone for $199. We're seeing great phones that are cheap too. So I hope that trend continues in 2019.
Well, thanks for setting up next week's show, Jerry.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to talk about the other side of the business. We're going to talk about the Moto G7, the other budget phones that are expected to be announced this year, and the fact that it's increasingly difficult to get something right in the middle. It's either you have really good phones that are inexpensive, really great phones that are super expensive. Where is the $500 phone going? I don't know. We'll talk about that next time. Until then, Jerry, Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you're listening, thank you. Send us your feedback, podcast@Android Central. My name is Daniel Bader, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
So long.
Adios.